Succession number 8663, rule number 3.
Rule 3.
Well, I must have been shocked, and obviously it didn't register completely what had happened. And I remember standing on the forecastle and looking at all the flotsam and all the people trying to survive. After a few minutes, some of the stronger swimmers had reached the destroyers, and they stood off a bit, or the Electra, it was by itself on the area that I was on, and they were waiting for people to come to the destroyer rather than steam through the debris and all the people in the water, which was a sensible thing. And then the stronger ones were getting there first, and then more and more gradually arrived and were hauled on board. And it was then that I realised how lucky I was and how lucky I'd been to be trained so well in the naval fashion, because lots of them were smothered in oil. They'd swallowed a lot of it. They were vomiting. Some were dying as they were pulled in onto the destroyer. And the quarterdeck was the hospital area, and they were all being laid out, those that were badly hurt, and some were badly burnt, and obviously by the flashes of explosions or something like that, because their skin was burnt and peeling. And the thing that was very pleasant, not at that time but later, shortly afterwards, that the captain of the Electra must have thought we all needed a drink and we all needed to be given a stimulant, because the next thing we knew, or not the next thing, but shortly later, the rum was being passed round, and I remember having two or three tots of rum, and of course we were all in, so took the shock away considerably, and we were sort of quite, not merry, but it alleviated things. But there really is a lot to be said before that. That came as we were going back to Singapore, having been saved. But I watched the all the debris. I recognised in the water many people that I knew. Some were hostilities only, and I saw them floating there, and they were dead. Many bodies that are about, talking of several hundred, I should think. Some of them were still alive and were brought in, and they dropped some over the side on our way back to Singapore that had died to make room and for others that were living. And another thing I saw was the aircraft flying about up above in the sky for some considerable time, and it often made me think that they were letting the destroyers pick up survivors without hindrance. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I have heard stories that some of the survivors were machine gunned, but I never saw anything like that. The aircraft were up there, and they could have sunk the destroyers if they'd have wanted to. No trouble at all. But they were able to pick up survivors unhindered, and I stood on the forecastle, and I was fascinated at the action then, which centred on the Prince of Wales. And they then were being bombed and blasted, and all the fire and flame and explosions, and they were getting a terrible time of it. And one of the destroyers, which I later found was HMS Express, one of the old destroyers in my flotilla, that pulled alongside, I think, or almost alongside, and I could see all the action taking place just as though it was on a cinema screen. And they kept bombing and bombing, no torpedoes this time, it was all bombing with the latter stage of the Prince of Wales. And in the end, she finally went down, and the destroyer had to make a rapid escape from her, otherwise she would have been badly damaged. And there was another destroyer in attendance, I believe, but I think there was three. But anyway, the two that I noticed was my own two destroyers, which had been in my old flotilla. And then after some time in the picking up survivors, and we looked around, and so far as I know, the destroyers weren't interfered with at all. They were allowed, and the aircraft eventually flew off, and there's not a shadow of doubt that they could have sunk the destroyers if they'd have wanted to, and wiped out everything that was there. And then we gradually returned to Singapore, and in advance our calamity had been passed, or they were aware of it, because when we got back to Singapore, there were all tables and people, and before we did anything at all, we had to pass through a checkout or a checkpoint where all our particulars were taken, and before we were allowed on into the naval barracks, which we went to, where we were able then, or told, that we had to go and wash and clean, and lots of people had terrific jobs of getting all the oil off. And it's a very vague thing. We were quite intoxicated. I remember being quite merry, or not merry, it's the wrong word, but I can remember being intoxicated to a degree through the rum, which still had its effect. And we then, having gone through the checkout and all our particulars and things, and it was obvious that they were going to tell our next of kin, and we then went on into the barracks, had a bath, went to bed as much as we could, and then there was all the kitting out procedures started to take place the next day, because I remember we then had a parade the next day when we were addressed by Captain Tennant, who was a survivor, and he addressed the whole of the ship's company of the Repulse that survived. And we also were aware that the Admiral had gone down with the ship, the Prince of Wales, and the Captain as well. And although we were mixing with the Prince of Wales survivors, for a day or two you mainly congregated with your own people and were looking for people you knew in your department when you'd been back on board the ship. And we were then in a state of some shock. It began to register with us, and we knew that the Japanese had landed right up in the northeast of the island, because we were all then started to be given jobs. All the Royal Marines of the Repulse were detailed to form a naval brigade on shore, and they departed off Singapore Island up towards the north. And I was given a rifle. Well, I was put on shift work, actually, on one of the Singapore dockyard gates. And there were some Indian troops there, I believe six, but I'm not sure. But they were Indian troops, and they could speak good English. And we were all there together with a little gatehouse. And I remember I had a rifle with, for several days anyway, had a rifle with several rounds to it. And this thing that surprised me was that the Indian soldier didn't have that. He only had a doing sentry go or whatever it was, checking on the gate, and he never had anything to fire with. He had some sort of sword or whatever they call it, with the some weapon anyway, but he never had that. And I was hopeless at shooting, and so I remember to this day saying to the Indian soldier, because they conveyed the impression that they were awfully efficient and smart, well drilled, and I said, well, if they ever get down here, and this is why we know they must have landed and we were told, is that you can have my rifle and the rounds and you'll do better with them than what I will. And so that went on for a number of days. I don't know how long, but we were sunk somewhere about the 10th of December, or it could have been the 11th of December, and we must have been there for, I suppose, about a fortnight, because I can remember a big parade whereby they took out all the people that were non-combatants or similar to me, like being an electrician and or working on torpedoes, and and also very young as well, because I was only 19, and they paraded, and we waited, and there was a ship making its getaway from Singapore, and it was all done very legitimate. They called all the names out on the parade ground, and then my name was called out, and a lot of the other boys and all the younger people all mustered in a different group, and we were very pleased to hear that we were going on this ship and we were going to be evacuated. Or perhaps that's the wrong word, because we didn't know that we were going to lose. Everybody thought that the guns on the Malaya and Singapore would be ample to take the Japs and prevent them from conquering the land of Malaya and Singapore. And also a thing which I missed out probably, which is important, is that in the naval action where the two ships were sunk, we never saw any aircraft whatsoever of our own. And so one thing is that it probably was the end of capital ships, because there's no doubt about it, whether even though you might have many anti-aircraft weapons on board, even in a modern ship like the Prince of Wales, well then I think that aircraft will always prevail, and the only defence to aircraft is to have aircraft on your side as well. But all the Japanese aircraft had uninterrupted passage over the ships, where everything they did they could do in their own time without being diverted, other than by the odd shells that the ships threw up, and from the repulse was very small amount. And so the aircraft was the vital factor. And we later saw, after it was all over, I think, one or two, I think they were Brewster Buffalo aircraft, certainly old type aircraft, that came over round the scene, but everything had happened by then. But even then, when we arrived back at Singapore, we were glad to get off of it, because we wanted another ship. We weren't land fighters, my type, because we were electricians and torpedo engineers, so to speak, and we couldn't have done a lot to assist in the defence of the country. We really needed to go somewhere and then get another ship and carry on with the fight that way. But we never thought the Japanese would conquer Malaya as easy as they did, and that again was a shock. We got away, and we were at sea on the 25th of December, so it pinpoints the time, how long I was there, and we were at sea on this old ship, and they had hardly any food on board, and they had goats, a number of goats. It was a foreign ship, an Indian ship, or some ship, where we lived on goat stew and goat's meat nearly all the way along, and it was very strictly rationed. And I always remember that the Exeter, where I'd served with in the repulse, we were at Plymouth when it came in from the Battle of the Plate, and I think, and it was all badly damaged as a result of the Graf Spee episode. And the Exeter, we were pleased to see her, because she was an 8-inch gun cruiser, and she escorted us quite a lot of the way back to Colombo in Ceylon. And we loved it all the time while we had her. And of course, at the time that we were a very slow ship in going along, but the main thing was that we were getting out of Singapore. And nothing happened on that trip, and we landed in Singapore with, I think, the clothes we stood up in, or near enough the clothes we stood up in, and we went to a naval barracks at Colombo, or just outside Colombo, where the kitting up and the giving us all our tropical kit and shoes and all different things like this was done. And I was in the camp given a job there as the broadcaster for all the different drafts and things like this, where you did it over the tannoy, and you were telling different people to muster here, and they got to another ship and so forth, or they were given a posting. And then ultimately I did get my posting, along with able seaman Williams, who lived at Truro, who was a seaman torpedoman like myself, and Chief Petty Officer Manley, who was the chief torpedo gunner's mate of the Repulse, which is a very high ranking position, and next in line to becoming an officer. He was the overall head of the torpedo and electrical department of Repulse, Chief Petty Officer Manley. And he had obviously picked me and the other chap to accompany him. He'd obviously been told what was required and what needed, and he'd selected us to accompany him and set off to form a torpedo bombing squadron nucleus set up at the Royal Naval Air Station China Bay, which was situated just outside Trincomalee, which was the opposite end of the island. And we went by train from Colombo across to Trincomalee, and again we had a very comfortable number of weeks there, because the Japanese were still engaged conquering Malaya, although we didn't know it, and Singapore fell, and then there was the battle in which the Exeter and the poor old Electra, which had saved me, were sunk in the East Indies. And then the Japanese fleet obviously came round and into the I think it's the Bay of Bengal or the Indian Ocean, where they then approached the Indian continent. And the island of Ceylon, a small island on the southern tip of India, was one of their targets, because the Trincomalee was a big naval base.
I think that you were concerned at China Bay with an incident in which the Japanese launched an air attack.
Yes, I realised that the crew, a lot of the crew of the Repulse and Prince of Wales, had been divided up and gone to different ships. I later heard that a lot of the boys went to the Dorsetshire and Cornwall, which were subsequently sunk off of Ceylon by the Japanese fleet. And Chief Petty Officer Manley, myself and my colleague arrived in China Bay Naval Air Station. There were Air Force personnel there, and it was a very comfortable position, and we then started to form torpedo bombing squadrons for the Fleet Air Arm at the air station. A number of Swordfish arrived, and torpedoes arrived, and depth charges in case they had to go, because they could carry, the Swordfish could carry depth charges. And we started to train with them, service them and maintain the torpedoes, get all the different priming agents like the primer, detonators and things like this, all the trolleys which you had to put the torpedoes on and wheel out under the aircraft. And we did all this and practiced with it, and we became reasonably efficient. And this was the first time that I had worked on torpedoes. But of course, the chief torpedo gunner's mate was an expert, and so he was in charge, and we were two that were doing it or obeying his instructions and doing it under his supervision. And we did do this, and one day they said that there was an alarm situation, and we had to put warheads on all the torpedoes and put them on the Swordfish aircraft, which were on the airfield, and the aircraft took off, and we never saw them again. They never came back to us at all. And it was then put about, I don't know who or by whom, but obviously there were aircraft maintenance fitters and people that worked on the aircraft as we worked on the torpedoes. And everybody heard that Colombo had been badly bombed, and that these Swordfish had flown into land and refuel, and where they were going to go out and attack the Japanese fleet, and they'd run into right in the middle of the bombing of Colombo, and all of them, according to the reports which we had, had been lost. We never saw any aircraft or any of their crew again, or any of our torpedoes. So we were then stuck with no aircraft, no torpedo bombing aircraft. There may have been some more torpedoes in the workshops. I can't remember. But I know that we were then out of a job. And I went out to the old aircraft carrier Hermes, which was anchored in the harbour, to do some work with their crew on torpedoes or do something like this. And I bumped into a petty officer, Monaghan, who was on the Hermes, and he was a repulse survivor. And I remember talking to him and saying how lucky we were and this, that and the other, and I did what work I had to do and returned at the end of the day. And then, within the next day or two, I was midway between the sleeping billets, our accommodation, and the aerodrome. And I'm not sure whether I was going to work or going back or what it was, but I know I was midway, and right alongside me was a great big storm drain, and I was on a road. And suddenly the whole of the air was filled with, again, Japanese aircraft. And the bombs came down, the hangars were destroyed, bombs over the airfield, and one very, very frightening thing was that the one of the aircraft had flown straight into an oil tank, a massive great oil tank, and it went up in flames, and it burnt for many days afterwards. In the evening and night it was a massive glow and flames, and there was a terrific amount of destruction, and my mind is very vague. I know that the Hermes and the attendant destroyer had left harbour, and that subsequently we heard, or it filtered back, that they'd been sunk just outside Trincomalee by these aircraft. And a few days afterwards, I can't remember the exact time, we were told that we were leaving, and we went on to a naval auxiliary. And we then, we didn't know where we were going, but we then went down to the east coast of Africa, and we went into the harbour of Mombasa in Kenya. And it transpired shortly afterwards that we were going to be sent to another place to not necessarily build an aerodrome, because local people and workmen and the native population probably would do that, but we were going to specialise in torpedoes and again try and do torpedo work with torpedo bombing squadrons. We were all very vague how it all tied up, but subsequently it transpired that a number of aircraft carriers gradually filtered out to the east coast of Africa, to Mombasa, a great big naval base there where lots of naval ships gradually formed. It was the Eastern Fleet, and we were going to train, possibly go into active service there if the Japanese fleet moved over. But the main thing which we subsequently did was to have a very large torpedo unit there, which we serviced the torpedoes, put on a dummy firing torpedo head, and then the aircraft would land from an aircraft carrier. Very, very frequent this happened. Every week, sometimes 2 or 3 days a week, they would land, and at the aerodrome. We would put these dummy aircraft on, torpedoes on, and then they would fly out to sea off the coast of Kenya or Tanganyika territory, and we would then go on a drifter, fly steer out in the direction where they were going to drop the torpedoes on a practice run, which would give the crews of the aircraft experience in dropping torpedoes and the height, speed, how to allow for all the different conditions. In other words, to train them to a high state of efficiency. And this happened, I suppose, in the course of the next 2 years that I was there, roughly. We did it many, many times. And after the torpedoes are fired and they'd run their course, they would incidentally fire them at a target that was already out on station, and then the torpedoes would turn upright in the water because of the way they were manufactured and built, and the head of the torpedo, which would be red or orange, would stick out of the water. And then in the drifter we had a sort of a lift thing that we could lift them out of the water with and lay them along the side of the drifter and the boat, and then bring them back into Tanga Harbour, which was where we were stationed, bring them back into Tanga, load them onto lorries, take them back to the airfield and the torpedo workshops, service them, and then a few days later another lot would land and be armed with these torpedoes. And we had more people joined us at that place as the time went by, and I remember being promoted to leading seaman as well while I was there. And the situation grew and grew, and the place got very active. It was a very large station after a few months, and there was many aircraft, not only Swordfish. But one thing that is, which will give people the idea of how to compare, I left Tanga to come home in Christmas 1943. I came home on a troop ship, the Arundel Castle. And I had to go by train back from Tanga all the way to Mombasa, which took us 3 days in the train each way, and you pass near the mountain of Kilimanjaro. I remember looking out and seeing that, and all the way through the game or the African jungle, and it was a very primitive type of railway. And you eventually came to Mombasa after 3 days, and that was the general route for everybody that was coming back to England. And after being the troop ship arrived, I went on the Arundel Castle. It travelled down to Durban in South Africa again, so I made another visit there. But it was a lot different because the effect of the war and the Japanese had affected them far more than when we'd originally visited them on the Repulse. And we were there, and I remember spending Christmas Day